हो CGSF 90.1 FM जो कि बर्नबी ब्रिटिश कोलंबिया में स्थित है.
But this is a despotic regime that has been indoctrinating its own population for 30 years with anti-Armenianism and Armenophobia. Who would want to live in Artsakh under the Azerbaijani despotic regime? Today, above 100,000 Armenians were ethnically cleansed and they're in Armenia. How are you going to convince them to go back to their homes and live under Azerbaijan, where their children have been killed during the war, where their fathers have been killed, where their families have been maimed? I mean, who would go and live there?
That's Bedros Dermatosyan, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Bedros Dermatosyan on Armenia, Artsakh, and Azerbaijan. Quickly lost in media coverage was a conflict that ended recently between the Armenians of Nagorno-Karabakh, Artsakh in Armenian, and Azerbaijan. It resulted in the ethnic cleansing of the Armenian enclave. This is a huge blow to the millennial-old Armenian people. Their land was under siege by Azerbaijan. On September 19th, Azerbaijan invaded. The outnumbered and outgunned Armenians had little chance against their more powerful neighbor. By the end of September, there were hardly any Armenians left in their ancient homeland. Armenians, the people who have endured massacres and genocide, are resilient, and they will heal their wounds and bounce back. Our guest today is Bedros Dermatosyan. He's professor of modern Middle East history at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. He's the author of The Horrors of Adana and editor of Denial of Genocides in the 21st Century. I talked with Bedros Dermatosyan in mid-October. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for inviting me.
The September 19th Azerbaijan attack on the Armenian enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh, which is called Artsakh in Armenian, has literally disappeared from media coverage. But I'd like you to talk about the history of the conflict and its origins. And, you know, it's very common to say, well, the Soviet Union was collapsing in the late 1980s, early 1990s, and then fighting broke out between two of the Soviet Socialist Republics, Azerbaijan and Armenia, and so you had the seeds of the crisis began there. But where's a good place to start?
I think a good place to start is go back to history. The region of what's known Nagorno-Karabakh has always been populated by Armenians. The majority were Armenians. So in the course of history, the region had its own leadership, its own princes, such as the five princes in the early modern period, such as the Meliks of Gulistan, Jorabert, Hachen, and Varanda. But the region has been also a crucial point of contention between the different political forces in the region, such as Russia and Persia. And it is only in the 19th century that Karabakh became a protectorate of the Russian Empire by the Kurekchai Treaty. And following the Persian-Russian War, 1804-1813, the Karabakh was ceded by the Persians to the Russian Empire per the Treaty of Gulistan. So after 1813 now, Nagorno-Karabakh becomes part of the Russian domination. At the time, it had 90.8% of its population were Armenians. So it remains until under the Russian domination of the Russian Empire until, let's say, the beginning of the formation of the Soviet Union. Still, it is under the Soviet rule to that extent. But the region, the contention of the region, does not start with the Soviet Union. It also intensifies at the beginning of the 20th century by the classic Russian divide and conquer methodology that it used to create tensions between the different ethnic groups within the region of the Caucasus. As you know, Karabakh is in the South Caucasus, an important strategic position. And it is in 1918, for example, that the Karabakh Council was established, and the leaders always have wanted it to be part of Armenia because they considered the land to be an Armenian land. And you have this period in the post-World War I period that you have different forces trying to claim Karabakh to themselves, whether is these are the Azerbaijani forces, whether these are the Kemalist forces, and whether these are whether this is General Antranik from the Armenians or Duro, the Dashnak leader. So you have a lot of kind of pull and push trying to secure Karabakh. The real problem starts, I think, not between the Armenians and the Azerbaijanis, but with the Soviet nationality policies, with the Soviet Union trying to create demographic engineering by putting one ethnic groups in a majority of another ethnic group and creating these tensions. So it was in 1921 that Nagorno-Karabakh was created as an autonomous oblast within the Soviet Azerbaijan. Of course, until 1921, Armenians of the region wanted to be part of the newly part of Armenia per se, whether it was independent Armenia that was established after the Armenian genocide in 1918 that lasted only 2 years, or whether it was during the formation of the Soviet Armenia. But their ambitions or their self-determination or their desire to become part of Armenia was defied by its integration into the Soviet Azerbaijan.
Stalin is the People's Commissar for Nationalities, and he's the one who put Karabakh into Azerbaijani territory. What was his motive? I mean, you suggested, was it simply divide and rule? Or did he want to curry favor with the regime in Turkey?
Yeah, either favor in the case of Turkey, but also to cater to the ambitions of the newly created Republic of Azerbaijan. Because at the end of the day, Armenia does not have much to offer to the Soviet Union in terms of natural resources. But it's part of the kind of the dirty Soviet game of, because it's not only Azerbaijan, it's also to do with Syunik, what today is called Zangezur, and Nakhichevan. So Armenians always have wanted to have Nakhichevan and Nagorno-Karabakh. But to that extent, these three provinces have been a source of contention for Azerbaijan. They do have Nakhichevan, and Nakhichevan is not, they do not have geographical contiguity with Nakhichevan. And that's why we come to the latest, which I can discuss later, about the desire of Azerbaijan to take by force some of the villages and to open by force a route that would connect Azerbaijan to Nakhichevan. And from Nakhichevan to Turkey is part of the grand Neo-Ottoman project, of the Pan-Turkic project of opening trade networks for economic benefits for the Republic of Turkey and that of Azerbaijan.
You see Pan-Turkic ideology as a factor in this equation?
Yes, there is a type of Pan-Turkic, but I can't say that specifically with the other Turkic republics, but for Turkey is the motto now between Azerbaijan and Turkey is that one nation, two states. And this is happening in the course of Erdogan's maximalist desires to have a saying in all parts of the Middle East, whether it's in Libya, whether it's in Syria, whether it's in Palestine, whether it's in Israel, whether it's in the Caucasus. But definitely, due to this war, Turkey has a more saying, a more clout within the region of the South Caucasus. And to that extent, Turkey played also a very dominant role in aiding Azerbaijan with the 2020 war, with supporting military intelligence, with supporting military aid, equipment, but also its generals played an important role in directing the war. So these are important aspects that we have to think, that it is larger than what Karabakh is. The whole idea is about power politics, it's about proxy war, Russian intervention, the Russian role, the Middle Eastern role, and Turkish role, and to that extent also Azerbaijan's ambitions now as the victorious party in this war to ask more from Armenia, specifically now wanting to have a corridor by force that would connect Azerbaijan to its other portion, which is Nakhichevan, which was passed through Mehri in the Sunni province. There is a fear that another war is going to start in the South Caucasus, and now that everyone is busy with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, that might also transpire there and no one is going to pay attention. Because as you can see, for 8 to 9 months, Nagorno-Karabakh was under siege and blockade. People were starving. And it was only in the last 3 weeks before the war started that international press started looking at what's happening in Nagorno-Karabakh, started condemning Azerbaijan. But, you know, when you are a despotic regime, you don't care about what the international community is saying. But also international community is based on their own interest, you know, oil. The British are interested in oil. Americans, they have their own agenda in the region. So,
what about the United Nations? Why didn't the UN step in to end this blockade and siege?
Actually, during the blockade, the Armenians did appeal to the International Court of Justice in order to intervene to bring an end to the blockade. But that also did not work. The ICJ, actually, on 22 February 2023, the court reached a legally binding ruling after 13-2 vote, thereby satisfying the request from Armenia and ordering Azerbaijan to take, and I quote, to take all measures at its disposal to ensure unimpeded movement of persons, vehicles, and cargo along the Lachin corridor in both directions. They issued this this order, legally binding ruling, but nothing happened. Azerbaijan did not follow the orders of the International Court of Justice. And also this shows you to what extent despotic regimes really respect international law or disrespect international law. And in the case of Azerbaijan, it's backed by Turkey. It's backed by even Russia to that extent. So it doesn't care what the United Nations is saying. As a matter of fact, it was after the ethnic cleansing that took place in Nagorno-Karabakh that Azerbaijan allowed for the United Nations to send a mission to Nagorno-Karabakh. And the mission came with some cars roaming around an empty city in Stepanakert, the capital, where there was no one left. And ironically, they wrote a report saying that there is no violence here and nothing has been damaged, whereby literally an ethnic cleansing has taken place. So again, it's the dysfunctional way in which United Nations functions. It's the way in which major power function. It's the way in which Armenia becomes sacrificed, or Armenians become sacrificed for international, you know, political agendas.
It's interesting to note, and you alluded to this fact, that people came very late to recognize what the impact of that siege and blockade was having on the people of Nagorno-Karabakh, Artsakh in Armenian. Someone who should have known better, who's half Armenian, by the way, is Nicholas Kristof, writing in the New York Times on September 3rd, just a couple of weeks before the Azeri invasion. He wrote a piece saying, "Are Armenians being ethnically cleansed?" And then, on the very day of the Azerbaijani attack on Nagorno-Karabakh, Artsakh, there was a full-page ad in the New York Times warning people of a possible genocide. I mean, they couldn't see what was right in front of them.
They saw, I think, but they were reluctant to write. My words is not about Nicholas Kristof, but it's about other presses in general who did not really want to see what was happening, because the world is occupied by one war, which is the Ukrainian war, which is a proxy war between the West and Russia, as you know. And to that extent, the far away you're from Europe, the less you're important to be covered as a case that needs to be that needs human attention. So in April, I wrote a long article which was published in Genocide Studies International, titled "Impunity, Apathy, and Lack of Humanitarian Intervention in the Case of the Blockade of the Lachin Corridor," which is the blockade actually, which is the only vein that provides, let's say, blood to Nagorno-Karabakh. And towards the conclusion, I said that there are two scenarios that's going to happen. The minimal scenario would be ethnic cleansing, and maximum would be genocide. As a matter of fact, that's what happened. Ethnic cleansing took place. And people argue, for example, Azerbaijani officials keep arguing that, well, Armenians left. And even the international press doesn't have the audacity to say that there was an ethnic cleansing. They say Armenians left, where you're not leaving to go to a trip over a weekend. You're leaving because there is an existential threat. The Western media has been always very biased towards Azerbaijan. I know there are interests, British Petroleum. We've gotten used to these things, you know, being uncovered, let's say not covered, being uncovered by mainstream media. And when the time comes that the event takes place, all right, then we see a pouring of articles about the event itself, which I call ex post facto coverage by the international media. Well, we don't need ex post facto coverage. We need coverage when the thing is taking place or prevent it. They say that genocide studies or genocide scholars study genocide to do two things: to understand why genocide takes place, and second, to prevent the happening of future crimes against humanity, ethnic cleansings, or acts of genocide. Again and yet again, the international community, whether it's the UN, whether it's the United States, whether it's the West, people think that relying on the West might alleviate the suffering of the Armenians. Others would say relying on Russians would alleviate the suffering of the Armenians. Well, I think relying on no one is much better than raising hopes of relying on this and that group, because all groups, all parties involved, whether it's Russia or whether it's the EU or whether the United States, have interest or their own political interest to intervene. It's not only for humanitarianism. It's all part of the regional politics. It's all part of trying to have a foothold in the South Caucasus, realizing maybe that Russia is power is waning there.
Besides brokering the 2020 peace accord, ending a 44-day war between the conflicting parties, the president of Russia, Putin, it is said that he was so fixated on Ukraine that he could not pay attention and fulfill his obligations to the Armenians of Karabakh because, as you said earlier, Russia historically, at least over the last couple of centuries, has been a kind of patron of Armenia, a protector.
Excellent question, David. Here's the thing. Armenia considered always Russia as its security guarantor, yeah? And Armenians of Artsakh considered Armenia as security guarantor. So when Russia failed with its duties to keep the security of Armenians of Armenia, then Nagorno-Karabakh Armenians were left alone. I don't buy the argument that Russia was unable to deal with the Caucasus, South Caucasus, because it's preoccupied with Ukraine. I think that Russia gave the green light for the 2020 war because nothing happens in that region without Russia's intervention. And maybe, I can't prove this, but the facts are there, that this is connected to the 2018 revolution that took place in the Republic of Armenia. And the results of the revolution were more disastrous than the result of not having the revolution, because some people would argue that the revolution revolution resulted in losing Nagorno-Karabakh, because at the end of the day, Russia doesn't want to see color revolutions around its neighborhood. Ukraine was the same. I remember Georgia was the same, and Armenia, I was always saying Armenia, when it's going to get the blow from Russia. And it did happen. It didn't happen through attacking Armenia, but happened through Nagorno-Karabakh. So some people might disagree with this, but this is my conviction. That's how things work. Russia is not weak in the South Caucasus. It has interests. It has also, it's part of the, it's an alliance with Armenia. So when the Azerbaijanis also attack Armenia and occupy 50 square miles from Armenia per se, Russia does not do anything. And Armenia is part of the CISTO, which is the Collective Security Treaty of Organization, which kind of a small NATO there. And at the beginning, they said, we cannot intervene in Nagorno-Karabakh because Nagorno-Karabakh is de jure part of Azerbaijan. But now that Armenia is attacked and the Armenian government is saying that, come and help us, and they're saying, well, we can. So what kind of alliances is this? On the contrary, Russia has more positive relations with the Republic of Azerbaijan because it seems that they have more interest from there. At the end of the day, it's a medium Azerbaijan to sell Russian gas to Europe, and that's what EU does, comes and shakes hands the Ursula, you know, the chairman of the EU comes, shakes hands with Aliyev for the gas, you know, the energy crisis. And Armenians also always pay the price of, regional politics and natural resources to that extent. But I said 2018 was disastrous, not because of its ideals, you know. At the end of the day, no one wants to live under a despotic regime. But I've become more cynical about revolutions, whether it's the Arab Revolution, whether it's the Armenian Revolution. These revolutions, to that extent, have been, you know, failing because they're not happening in a vacuum. There are many governments who are interested in sabotaging these revolutions so that they do not head towards the democratic path. But Armenia still today, you know, within democratic path. I don't know what's going to happen. And there's a major threat against Armenia by Turkey and Azerbaijan. So it's we're going to see what's going to happen when the issue comes to the corridor, the Zangezur corridor, because the Azerbaijanis, Aliyev, is adamant that corridor should be opened. You cannot just enter a country and claim a road through the country connecting to other parts and say, this is my corridor. That can't happen.
Well, we'll see what the so-called rules-based international order, what its response would be to such an eventuality of annexation of land, basically, invasion and annexation. But you mentioned the distinguished president, that's in quotes, of Azerbaijan, Aliyev, Ilham Aliyev, and I'm not going to quote you. I'm going to quote Richard Silverstein in Tikkun Olam. This is what he wrote about Ilham Aliyev. Azerbaijan is ruled by a corrupt dictator who has amassed enormous wealth from the country's oil and other natural resources. He's stolen as much of it as he can to enrich himself and his interests. In 2013, the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project declared him its Corrupt Person of the Year. His greed and territorial ambitions have only grown since then. And then he goes on to write, Richard Silverstein, that there's an interesting alliance between Azerbaijan and Aliyev and Israel and Netanyahu. Israel provides 70% of the countries of Azerbaijan's weapons over the last 5 years. So talk about the president of Azerbaijan and the relationship between Israel and Azerbaijan.
Based on the freedom of house ranking of freedom of expression in Azerbaijan, it's 9 out of 100. Armenia is 50. Azerbaijan is 9. There is no freedom of expression. It's a despotic regime. Its own population is suffering. And think, how can Aliyev strengthen his despotic regimes through opening another war and claiming himself as the hero, etc., etc.? whenever we speak about Azerbaijan, we're not speaking about the nation itself. The nation itself is a victim of the indoctrination of hatred, Armenophobia against Armenians. We're speaking about, against a corrupt regime, which is the heir to Haydar Aliyev, his father, who's a KGB official. And Ilham took the reins in his hand and appointed his wife as the vice president. And he is a corrupt figure who funnels millions of dollars, involved in money laundering, caviar diplomacy. And everyone knows about the caviar diplomacy, the extent to where major political leaders come to Baku and they're being given major gifts, very expensive gifts, whether caviars or other gifts. Aliyev is corrupt. He uses the natural resources of his own country, whereby there is poverty in his country and people are suffering in his country. Opposition figures are in prison. And to that extent, it brings me now to the, not weird, but to the kind of alliance with Israel. So experts estimate that Israel has supplied around 70% of Azerbaijan's arsenal between 2016 and 2020. Haaretz, for example, a major Israeli newspaper, counted that 92 Azerbaijani military cargo flights have landed to Ovda military airport in Israel between 2016 and 2020. And they purchased major Israeli weapons, which included intelligence-gathering drones, Hermes UAVs, Spike anti-tank missiles, Atmos self-propelled guns, Cardum mortars, Barak anti-aircraft missiles, Searchers, Heron drones, Navy patrol ships, Typhoon gun mounts, Spike missiles, etc., etc. But mostly the Harops UAVs, which are suicide kamikaze drones. And with all that equipment, Azerbaijan attacked, supported by Turkish Bayraktars, Turkish intelligence commanders, by jihadi fighters coming from Syria. And they thought that they could subjugate the armies of Nagorno-Karabakh in a couple of days. But it took 44 days. With all this military equipment, with all this technology, Armenians put a strong fight. But they suffered too. They lost the war. Armenians lost the war, and Azerbaijan is also, if you think about it, lost the war because thousands of their own soldiers were killed, who were sent to the front by Aliyev in order to achieve his territorial ambition and strengthen his corrupt legitimacy within the country as a supreme leader. Israel has other objectives. Oil that it gets from Azerbaijan, but also Iran is an extremely important aspect. Iran is not happy with the results of the Nagorno-Karabakh war. Iran knows that Israeli Mossad intelligence is very active in Azerbaijan and monitoring the activity of the Iranians. The one thing I can say for sure, the Israeli weaponry played an important role in the ethnic cleansing of Armenians. This is not me saying. These are articles that have been written by Haaretz newspaper, the second most widely circulated newspaper in Israel. The people know the role of Israel in the defeat of the Armenians, towards the end, in the ethnic cleansing of the Armenians. Maybe not direct role, indirect role, but to that extent, giving the superiority, strengthening the military superiority of Azerbaijan. And Azerbaijan's military budget is a couple of billion dollars per year, which totals all the budget of the Republic of Armenia. And it has tons of money that can buy anything from Israel. And it comes down also, David, to the fact that Israel has never recognized the Armenian genocide. And there could be a correlation here. You know, had Israel recognized the Armenian genocide, would it be also complicit in helping another entity to commit crimes against Armenians? So that's a kind of the moral question here. But always Israel has played on the card of the Armenian genocide, the threat of recognizing it in its own businesses with Turkey and with Azerbaijan.
You're listening to Better